Welcome to the Meisner Tierney Bizcast, a law podcast designed to provide information regarding corporate, litigation, tax, real estate, and other business matters. Meisner Tierney Fisher & Nichols attorneys produce these materials on a regular basis, covering topics that are current and relevant to owners, professionals, and others in the business community. Although we obviously can't provide legal advice that you can rely on in these presentations, we do hope that they will be helpful if and when you ever do need professional advice.
Hey, MTFN BizCast listeners, a quick programming update before diving into today's episode. Since we recorded this, the court removed the case Green Bay Professional Police Association v. City of Green Bay from its oral argument calendar for October. It's the first case discussed in the podcast, but we've decided to leave the discussion in the podcast since the case will be heard later this term. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Meisner Tierney BizCast. My name is James Sosnowski, and I'm an attorney here at Meisner Tierney Fisher & Nichols. Today I'm here with another attorney at the firm, Caleb Gerbitz, and we'll be discussing the civil cases in the Wisconsin Supreme Court coming up next month. Caleb spent 2 years working as a law clerk for Justice Brian Hagedorn on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and I clerked for Justice Hagedorn for 3 years while he was a Court of Appeals judge. I also spent a year clerking for Justice Rebecca Bradley on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So the court's October oral argument calendar is quite full. It has 7 civil cases set to be heard, a lot of interesting issues, including a couple of public employment disputes, a pair of tax questions, and Section 1983 is going to make a rare appearance in state court. So, Caleb, why don't you tell me a little bit about this case coming up, Green Bay Professional Police Association v. City of Green Bay.
Absolutely. So we're starting off the month with a case that's got a bit of federal law going on. So there was a police officer who faced disciplinary action at the hands of his department due to accessing and leaking some confidential information. And the dispute, really, there are some due process requirements for the type of notice you have to give to the employee before you can discipline them. And a lot of those notice requirements are articulated in a case called Cleveland Board of Education v. Loudermill. The argument that was made is that the Loudermill requirements weren't satisfied here. This case went to arbitration initially. The arbitrator said no, Loudermill was satisfied. Circuit court, it then went to circuit court on a motion or a declaratory judgment action to vacate the arbitral award. Circuit court said no, Court of Appeals said no.
So basically the arbitration decision stands, and the Court of Appeals held that it was going to stand, and then the Supreme Court ended up taking the case. Any thoughts on why that must be?
You know, it does seem like an odd case to grant. You know, Loudermill is a federal precedent. So this court's kind of sitting as, in some sense, an inferior court to the U.S. Supreme Court. My guess is, you know, it's possible that they just want to clear up some Loudermill precedent in Wisconsin, but I think they might be more interested in the arbitration aspect of this.
Wisconsin's arbitration statutes.
Yes. Yeah. So the case is, it's an attempt to have an arbitral award vacated. And it turns out that's really tough to do in Wisconsin under Wisconsin statute section 788.10.
That's actually pretty universal, I think, across most states. The arbitration awards are really hard to overturn, because if they were easy to overturn, then you know, it would kind of eliminate the usefulness of them, because you just, you know, appeal up to the circuit court and get another bite of the apple, or more precisely, file a declaratory judgment action in the circuit court and just retry the case. The whole point of arbitration is to limit costs and make things easier and more streamlined. And so the scales are really tipped against overturning arbitration awards. So I'm still kind of puzzled why, given that the Court of Appeals affirmed the circuit court's, you know, denial of the or dismissal of the DEC action, I'm just kind of searching in my head for what stuck out about this case that the court granted the petition for review.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, the standard is manifest disregard of the law. It's not just like a regular misapplication of law. We have seen over the last few years some appetite to take arbitration cases. The courts decided probably one or two a year for going back a number of years. So we'll see what they do with it.
So Caleb, moving on to the next case, St. John's Communities, Inc. v. City of Milwaukee. What's going on here?
So this, I mean, this is, it's a tax case, and it is the ultimate case of the devil's in the details. There's a basically a facility in Milwaukee, and I believe it's a senior living facility, and they built a new building, and there was some question about whether that building would be exempt from taxes for charitable purposes. And the city assessed it as taxable and levied a tax against it. And St. John's challenged the tax before any taxes were collected.
So it challenged it before the city. So it brought it before the city, not in front of the court.
Right, right. And that's what the statute says you have to do. And this is where things get a little weird. The statute says, quote, person aggrieved by the levy and collection of an unlawful tax. So the city said, we haven't collected any taxes yet because you haven't paid anything. Therefore, your claim is denied. So St. John's goes and pays the tax and then immediately institutes a circuit court action to challenge the city's decision to deny their appeal of their tax assessment. So, I mean, the question now is, can their case go forward when they're current on their taxes now, but they weren't current on their taxes at the time they started their challenge?
So it sounds like what this is going to really hinge on is what does the language levy and collection mean, which seems, at least by my read, to be relatively straightforward. You know, the tax actually has to be collected. And then it's just a question of the circuit court's review of the city's decision on the tax appeal, which at the time of that decision, they hadn't paid the tax, right?
Correct. They had not paid the tax.
And they only paid that tax subsequently. So, it should be interesting to see how the court reads the statutes. Because typically when you're reviewing kind of municipal actions in front of the circuit court, you're confined to the record that's in front of whatever that decision-making body is. And so if the assuming that, you know, the statute requires you to actually pay the tax first, and those are the facts before the city when they made that decision, it kind of seems like it was correct. But, you know, the court took it for some reason.
So, I mean, you mentioned when we were preparing for this, competency is a concept. I don't think the Court of Appeals used the term. But if the statute says the tax has to have been collected by the time a claim was filed with the city, how strictly does that statutory requirement need to be enforced? Sometimes there are statutory requirements where the court's just like, look, we know it says that, but we're not going to enforce that strictly. And maybe this is an opportunity for them to say something about competency, and maybe they say this, you know, isn't a big deal, and that the substantial compliance with the statute's enough. I don't know.
That's kind of been my thought. The only thing that I could think of, because if you're just looking at the statute, it doesn't look like St. John's, you know, complied with it, and that's kind of it's a requirement of seeking review. I guess it could just be that the court wants to authoritatively construe the statute. I mean, I didn't look at the Court of Appeals decision in detail, but, you know, if there's no case law on it other than this one Court of Appeals decision, that might explain why the petition was granted.
That makes sense, yeah. All right, James, do you want to take us to the second case set for argument on October 6th, Dostal v. Strand?
Sure. This case has got pretty sad facts to it. It's a summary judgment case, and the issue is whether a father's conviction for second-degree reckless homicide of his infant daughter prevents the mother from recovering, from the father's homeowner insurance policy. And so this is really just an issue of whether or not the damage was accidental or not, because typically insurance policies only apply to accidental or unintentional damage. The Court of Appeals affirmed the circuit court, and the circuit court granted summary judgment for the insurer, saying that the insurance company didn't have to pay because no reasonable jury could conclude, in light of the criminal conviction against the father, that the daughter's death was an accident. And because it's not an accident, it's not a covered occurrence. Before the Supreme Court, the mother is primarily arguing that the Court of Appeals shouldn't have given weight to this criminal conviction, and claims that there is at least an issue of material fact as to whether or not the death was accidental or not. But this issue comes up has come up a few times before, most notably in Tally, recently in Tally v. Mustafa, where the Supreme Court addressed whether or not there was an incident where an alleged employee of a store, intentionally hit one of the customers, and the plaintiff in that case was trying to get around the requirement that there be an accident and the damage be unintentional by bringing a negligence claim against the store owner. And the court held no, it's still intentional. Really, these damages flow from an intentional act, the intentional hit. And so it does seem like, at least at first glance, this should proceed along very similar lines.
Well, the one thing that does make this kind of where it deviates from Tally just a little bit that I find interesting is the mother saying, yes, I know that the father, the homeowner, in this case the insured, was convicted of second-degree reckless homicide. And that means the jury must have found that he did some intentional things, or reckless things, however you look at that. But she's saying that the Court of Appeals improperly gave that criminal conviction preclusive effect, is the term she uses. And she uses issue preclusion terminology, which I think that's probably not established here. But it's an interesting question. So if you have a summary judgment motion, and there's a criminal conviction where a jury has found beyond a reasonable doubt that someone did something, can you allege a disagreement of fact with what the criminal court decided? Or should the court on summary judgment say, no, look, a court's already weighed in on this, and no one can reasonably disagree that, in this case, that the father recklessly killed the daughter?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the way that the mother frames this as being issue preclusion, even though it's not really issue preclusion. And I think that may be, an attempt to increase the likelihood, and apparently successfully, if this was what she intended to do, increase the likelihood that the court would take the case, because it would be a very odd situation for the court to have applied issue preclusion, since the insurer wasn't a party to the criminal proceedings, and neither was the mother. And so you would be essentially applying preclusive effect to a ruling that, a ruling in a case where neither of the parties were actually involved. They weren't a party to the case. Only the father was, and that his liability isn't really the issue here. So I mean, it could be, That could have been, sort of a recasting of what happened there. But I guess I'm failing to see how issue preclusion would even come into it, or why should we use that term?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to, a summary judgment case and figuring out what that standard, or how that standard works here.
Exactly.
I'm also curious, I guess there's this other side of it, and this is what the Court of Appeals spent most of their time on. The question of whether a criminal conviction for second-degree reckless homicide precludes, and that's maybe the wrong term to be using, but if second-degree reckless homicide equals not an accident, and you're almost kind of looking at the statute for second degree reckless homicide and figuring out whether the elements line up with accident or not accident or what have you.
Yeah, so basically, is recklessness an accident? That could be another thing that the court wants to clarify. If the primary evidence in this case is the criminal conviction, then that directly raises the question of, is recklessness an accident as defined in the insurance policy? So I know that hasn't been addressed squarely before, or at least I don't think it has.
Yeah, you know, and then one last thing about this, it reminds me of a case recently, I guess a couple years ago now, called Kemper v. Society Insurance, where it was kind of a, you know, there's a, I think it was a published Court of Appeals opinion in that case as well, I can't recall. But you know, there's a victim here who is attempting to recover from an insurer. In this case, this mother who lost her daughter under tragic circumstances. And I'm curious if that might have factored into the decision to grant the case and to take a second look at, you know, just to make sure, you know, that the, you know, Court of Appeals correctly concluded that she doesn't get any recovery out of these, you know, admittedly tragic circumstances.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Should we move ahead to October 10th, oral argument in Slaby v. Dunn County?
Sure thing. This is that 1983 case that you're talking about. So,
if I'm not mistaken, this is Justice on Wheels, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to occur. The oral arguments are not going to occur in Madison. Instead, they're going to go to the Waupaca County Courthouse. I hope I pronounced that correctly. To consider, it's an inmate's Section 1983, which is a federal statute, claim that Dunn County failed to adequately protect her from a correctional officer's sexual assault. Now, the standard under 1983 is the county would have to would have had to show a deliberate indifference to a substantial risk that this correctional officer would sexually assault the inmate. What's odd about and very interesting about this case is why the Supreme Court would take it. It seems like a pretty straightforward, you know, case of what facts are disputed and what facts aren't disputed. You know, the Supreme Court tends to act on cases of statewide importance, and additionally, this is under a federal statute, and because it's under a federal statute, you know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, while it can offer binding interpretations on it that are binding to Wisconsin courts, it can't authoritatively construe a federal statute. It can, and maybe that's what it wants to do, is just offer clarification to the lower courts in this state about how it reads Section 1983. But it's interesting. You don't get a 1983. There are a lot of 1983 cases brought, and you don't get a lot of them in a state Supreme Court like ours.
That's true. I've got a couple of theories, and one might just be, you know, maybe 1983 law is just a mess in Wisconsin. I haven't heard that that's the case, but, you know, maybe they want to clarify something in that field. The other possibility is, you know, this is another case where you have a victim, in this case, a victim of sexual assault, who is denied relief in court. So it might be another instance where the court wants to take a second look, you know, make sure that the Court of Appeals got this one right, given, you know, the stakes here for the victim.
Yeah, and I think it's probably worthwhile to add that, you know, even though the Supreme Court often, you know, phrases its task as, you know, simply addressing issues of statewide importance, a lot of times, if the errors are substantial or if something serious is at stake, even if it's not necessarily an issue of statewide importance, they will sometimes take cases because, you know, they do have the power to correct errors in lower courts. And maybe there's an error here that I'm missing. I mean, I'm certainly no 1983 expert. I've actually never dealt with a 1983 case, but you know, maybe they just see something here that they want to clarify or correct.
Well, James, you've given us a great segue into the next case, which, you know, could fall into this category of taking a closer look at something because it's, you know, significant in the area where it's where it impacts.
Yeah, as opposed to the statewide.
Yeah, so you want to take us into Milwaukee Police Supervisors?
Milwaukee Police Supervisors Organization, the City of Milwaukee. This is about a collective bargaining agreement and a benefit calculation provision in that collective bargaining agreement. It's between the City of Milwaukee and the Milwaukee Professional Firefighters Association, Local 215. Now, this collective bargaining agreement provides for both a pension contribution and a pension offset payment. So the participants would pay a pension contribution, and then the city would pay back out a pension offset payment. And the issue is this offset payment. The parties disagree whether certain duty disability retirement beneficiaries who do not make pension contributions, so they're not paying into the system, are entitled to a pension offset payment anyway under the contract. The Court of Appeals read the contract and said no, and just looked to the plain language in the, or what it believed was the plain language in the collective bargaining agreement. And it read the agreement as conditioning the offset payment on making contributions in the first place. Interestingly enough, this wasn't at issue in the appeal, but there was a second collective bargaining agreement that was construed that didn't go up on appeal. And in that collective bargaining agreement, the circuit court concluded that claimants were entitled to the offset.
Court of Appeals, I think, right?
Oh, the Court of Appeals. That's right. But it's not being appealed up to the Supreme Court. Thanks for the correction there.
The city let that one go after losing at the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, and so I think you mentioned, you know, kind of leading this off about this may not be an issue of statewide importance, but it's certainly of a lot of importance to Milwaukee. This isn't the first time that, and very recent memory, that the Supreme Court has taken a case to interpret benefit provisions in a collective bargaining agreement. I think in 2018 or 19, 2019, the Supreme Court issued a decision on benefit provisions in Milwaukee District Council 48. And that was likewise a contract interpretation case, reading the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement and the relevant county ordinances to that effect. And the court took it anyway and, you know, definitively interpreted that contract. So,
yeah. This one looks destined for a couple 1L contract interpretation books, maybe.
Maybe. I don't think I've seen District Council 48 in any contract books yet, but I have to admit I haven't looked. Caleb, I understand you have a particular interest in the next case, Alsop Venture Partners, the Murphy Desmond SC. I was looking at the facts, and this is super complex. Why don't you take a stab at breaking this one down?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is like my favorite type of case because it arises from a very thorny, big, tricky, factual situation. And then it basically distills down to a pretty simple legal question. In this case, the legal question is evidentiary. But let's start with the big, thorny, factual situation. So way back in 2001, there was this massive corporate transaction. It was a essentially the sale of a business. And there were a bunch of financial advisors and lawyers involved. And through one thing and another, the plaintiffs in this case ended up with $46 million in unexpected tax liabilities.
So to get this straight, all of the accountants and lawyers and specialists in the room represented that they wouldn't be having these tax consequences, right?
Yeah. So somebody screwed up, and this case
according to the plaintiffs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they paid taxes they weren't expecting to pay. So the screw up is admitted. The question is, who's responsible for the screw up? And so there's negligence claims and a variety of other claims. So there were a ton of defendants in this case. I can't recall the number. And as happens with this sort of litigation, a lot of the defendants settled out along the way. And after those settlements occurred, the plaintiffs they amended their complaint so that it only stated the remaining defendants. And the remaining defendants cried foul. They didn't like that because the jury would only see that there were these few people that the plaintiffs were suing rather than this big group of people. So what they did, and the circuit court allowed this, is they introduced the original complaint to show the jury that there had been other parties to the lawsuit. They introduced evidence showing the fact that settlement agreements had been reached. And this is the remarkable one to me. They introduced evidence about how much those settlements were worth. And I think one of them was worth like $25 million, just huge sums. And now on appeal, the plaintiffs are saying, look, there is a statute that says settlement evidence is generally inadmissible. That's WSSTAT 904.08. And this is kind of 2L evidence stuff. You know, settlement evidence, not admissible. But the statute has this exception. You can admit settlement evidence if the evidence is offered to prove, quote, bias or prejudice of a witness.
Interesting.
And, yeah. So here, you know, they're not saying any witness has changed their testimony or anything. But the Court of Appeals affirmed. And it said, look, there's this case called Morden v. Continental AG from 2000, in which the Supreme Court said that this bias or prejudice of a witness exception applies when the posture of a settling party is significantly different as the result of settlement. And so now the court's kind of looking at these two things that they've got. They've got the statutory language that's a language that says bias or prejudice of a witness. And then you have this case law text that seems a little broader and says the posture of a settling party has changed.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting to me because, I mean, judges and lawyers, you know, we're all lawyers here. And one of the critical things that we rely on is the fact that when we go into settlement negotiations, everything about those settlement negotiations, including the fact of settlement and the amount, it's going to be confidential. That doesn't get used against us later as a weapon. It's an encouragement for parties to be open and honest about the, you know, their relative chances in their cases. So anytime where there's an exception to this rule where evidence of that settlement is being allowed in, I think it makes everyone a little bit nervous. And I'm thinking that the court may want to at least make, you know, give this a good hard look and make sure that the rules about when these settlement communications and when settlement information can be introduced as evidence, make sure that that's very clearly defined. That's at least my thinking on this.
I think that's right. I mean, they're going to try to, my guess is they're probably going to try to rein in Morden a little bit. And I don't know what they'll say, if they'll modify it or if they'll just say, you know, what we meant was, you know, what the statute says. And then, you know, I don't know what they do as far as deciding the case after that. I can see the argument, you know, that these plaintiffs are witnesses and they're changing their attitude a little bit. It seems a little strained, but I can see how you get there. So this is one I'm watching pretty closely. It's always fun when the court's dealing with past precedents, comparing them to statutes. It raises a lot of legal issues that people get pretty passionate about. All right, should we turn to our last case, James?
Yeah, Citation Partners. This is another tax case.
Sure like the tax cases.
Yeah, they do. So Citation Partners v. Department of Revenue. And the issue here is the characterization of certain expenses within a lease agreement. So generally in Wisconsin, a lease of tangible personal property, the total amount of consideration, so everything that the lessor is paid for the lease of the property is considered taxable. However, there's a relatively recently enacted statute that creates a deduction.
And real quick on that, recently enacted statutes, if you talk about a recently enacted statute in your petition for review, the court likes to look at recently enacted statutes. But sorry, go ahead, James.
Yeah, and it's not a deduction. I misspoke. It's an exemption for It's a sales tax exemption for certain purchases of aircraft parts and aircraft service. So that brings us to the facts of the case. You know, Citation Partners owns a private plane and is leasing it. Now, its lease agreement provides that the lessor, so it, the Citation Partners, is going to provide the, is going to be responsible for maintaining the plane. And then as part of the lease agreement, it includes a separate charge for maintenance to that plane. And so it's arguing that that this separate charge that they're charging to the lessees for leasing their plane to reimburse it for maintenance expenses is covered under the sales tax exemption. And I think it's going to turn on the interpretation of these two statutes. So the general rule about leases of tangible personal property being subject to sales tax, and then this exemption. And there's some rules of construction that are pretty interesting. You know, for instance, the Court of Appeals focused on that the fact exemptions are narrowly construed. And so,
So the Court of Appeals, and you know, as I started reading this Court of Appeals opinion, I was like, at first I was thinking, no, there's no way. It was Judge Donald of District 1. And I got to be honest, as I kept reading it, he kind of won me over. I'm not quite sure what the right answer is, but I got through and I was like, all right, you know, his opinion makes a lot of sense. And he says, look, Section 77.51 says you tax the total amount of consideration.
In a lease agreement.
In a lease agreement, yep. And, you know, we've got this other new exemption that clearly applies if it's like a direct purchase of aircraft maintenance. But it's not so clear that it would apply if that's part of a lease agreement, and lease agreements aren't mentioned in the exemption in the statutes. So we're going to construe that exemption strictly as we say we do. Therefore, the tax applies to the entire lease payment.
Yeah, and I think my thought process on this case, it was similar to yours. Like, my initial instinct is like, well, I mean, it's reimbursement for repair costs. And like, the more I thought about it and the more you talked to me, I don't know. I'll be interested to see where the Supreme Court comes out, because I'm at least somewhat on board with the Court of Appeals decision here, but we'll see. There's also another interesting argument that Citation Partners, the lessor, argues. It argues that it was acting as the agent of the lessees when it procured the repair and maintenance services to the aircraft, to try to head off the argument that it's not, you know, the exemption doesn't apply because they're providing the services indirectly. So it's not Citation Partners who is providing the maintenance in exchange for the reimbursement. It's going out and finding somebody to conduct the plane maintenance and then charging the lessor for that amount. And so that factored into the decision as well. So it's really shaping up to be a pretty interesting and very full month of civil cases in front of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, absolutely. Fortunately, looking ahead to November, it cools off a little bit. I think there's only three cases, but we anticipate taking a look at those when the time comes.
Yeah. I guess we'll be back for that.
Thank you for listening to this Meisner Tierney BizCast. We hope this information will be helpful to you. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access this and other podcasts, as well as other useful information. If this has been helpful, please feel free to subscribe, leave a review, or provide other input.